This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of September 20th, 2021, brought to you by First Person Advisors, a subsidiary of NFP. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. As I've probably mentioned a few times in recent years, my wife and I have a young son. He just started kindergarten in August. We already have received the results of his first standardized test. And in a real surprise for my wife and I, given that we both have masters of fine arts degrees, our son, for now, ranks very high in math. According to the printout of the results, he's good at thinking algebraically, while his parents think allegorically. And because we are college-going folk, this already has us thinking about where he might end up. Now, to be honest, we've been saving for his college education since he was born, but this is about the extent of our understanding about what we need to be doing. And suddenly we're asking, you know, how much do we need to have saved by the year 2034? In fact, as you'll hear in today's podcast, I very recently used an online tool from Vanguard to figure out how much college will cost in the mid-2030s, depending on the school he might attend. The results were absolutely horrifying. We're talking from $200,000 for 4 years of a state education, and that is just the sticker price, to be clear, to more than $600,000 for an upper echelon Ivy League style degree. Clearly, we needed to have a better idea of how we should approach the college funding issue over the next 13 years. So, for this edition of the IBJ Podcast, I asked columnist Pete Dunne, aka Pete the Planner, to give me an overview and some of the most important do's and don'ts. We discuss where the money comes from, the loans that you should embrace and the ones that you should run from, balancing your desire to help your child stay debt-free or as debt-free as possible with ensuring you have a well-funded retirement, and deciding whether the return on your investment for a big-name school is worth another five or six figures worth of debt. So, here's our conversation. As always, I'm pleased to be joined by Pete the Planner. How are you doing?
Good. I always want you to go joined by my friend, Pete the Planner, but you just skip the my friend part, but I'll get over it.
You know, I think I'm not supposed to express any opinion about anything.
Well, yeah. Okay today.
Thank you. I would like to say that I'm feeling very sort of ambivalent about you as well.
Thank you. That's, sure. That's helpful.
Okay. So for the purposes of this conversation, I want to give our listeners just a smidge of perspective on our interests in this subject. I will go first. My wife and I have a five-year-old who just started kindergarten. We definitely want him to be able to go to college, at least help him pay for college, if that's the route that he wants to take 13 years from now. And you, do you have college payments in your future?
Absolutely. 12-year-old and a 9-year-old. So if I can be cliche for one moment, boy, it goes fast, Mason. I can't believe I'm 6 years away from potentially getting my first bursar's bill.
So let's get right to it. Once you have decided there is a high probability that your child will go to college, the first question that might pop into your head is, when should I start saving? I will pose that question to you. When should you start saving for college?
You know, that's a trick question, whether you know it or not, because, you know, some people will say at conception, the child has a high likelihood of going to college. And others would say, I won't know that until the end of the first semester of their senior year. I mean, I'm not being glib, but that is true. People view it that way. The unfortunate part is if you're in the latter group, it's too late, and more mistakes can be made at that point in time than any other time because you're scrambling, you feel guilt, you are stressed. And so you adopt this attitude of, we'll do whatever it takes to accomplish this thing that seems seemingly impossible, which is, you know, the American spirit. However, the American spirit is also deeply in debt. And not only can you ruin the child's financial future, believe it or not, but you can very much so ruin your own. I know here in a little bit, I recently read a study, a new NerdWallet survey about Parent Plus loans and the debt parents are taking on for college. So I'd love to talk about it as we unravel this topic today, because it's terrifying, if I can be honest.
Yeah, we'll get to it. I've got that on my list. How common is it for a family, let's say, to reach the high school years without having saved any money?
Incredibly common. And without data in front of me, I would say it is, in my opinion, anecdotally, it is the most common thing. For a junior or senior in high school to go to their parents and say, I'm starting to think about schools, or the parents to go to them and say, hey, are you thinking about schools? And then the start of the conversation is, okay, so mom and I have not saved as much money as we would want to. And then the kid says, well, how much? And I don't know why they're using that voice, but that's what they say. And then the middle-aged man says, well, nothing. We've saved nothing. And I'm saying that in a joking way because it's an uncomfortable thing. But that's a very common thing for folks. And I'll also note, Mason, that it's not because parents don't want to save money. It's often just because they can't. Maybe they're doing the best they can. Maybe they're raising five or six kids. My dad came from a family of eight kids. And so to try to save in that environment in today's current climate is nearly impossible.
So maybe to answer the question, to the extent that you can start saving for college, you know, when your kid is in single digits, sounds like you should.
Absolutely. And I think often what times people start to look at the reasons why they shouldn't do that, which don't make a lot of sense, right? First off, there's two primary vehicles in which people are going to save for college, and they are the Roth, and this is in no particular order. The Roth IRA is a great tool to put money in for your kid's college, which can be used penalty-free at college. And by the way, if they don't go to college, it's an IRA. It's an individual retirement account, and it sticks and hangs around for your own retirement. The second vehicle, of course, which is now a good time to disclose that I'm a paid endorser of said second vehicle, is a 529 plan. So within the tax code, there is section 529, and that is a college savings for kids. And the issue with that can be that if a kid does not go to school, then there can be penalty for what we would call non-qualified distributions at that point in time. And Mason, where I'm going with this is sometimes people create these barriers by saying, well, if they don't go to college, then we got a big penalty. It's not that big of a penalty, and it shouldn't preclude you from saving for college.
This is great. We're on the same wavelength here, because that was literally my next question. I wanted to go through very quickly, a quick glossary, if you will, of the ways that we pay for college. There's two of the ways that you just mentioned. There's the Roth, so I can make contributions to the Roth IRA and then withdraw if it's a qualified distribution, I'm assuming.
Well, I mean, you can always take money out of a Roth IRA. You would only have to, because you've already paid taxes on that money. The only difference is taking the gains out of the Roth IRA would not be taxed when you use them for college, because you can take money out of your Roth to go on vacation. Don't take money out of your Roth to go on vacation, but you can't take the gains without having taxation associated with that.
And there's the 529, which is what my wife and I are using for our son. The way I understand it is I put money in there. It's like an investment account. It's invested somewhere. It goes up. It accrues value in addition to whatever I put in there. And then I've got something at the end.
Yeah. People would not be wrong to say, oh, it's like a 401k for college. I mean, it is not a 401k for college, but essentially it's a 401k for college.
And then there's some tax advantages in Indiana. You could put in X amount of money.
Yeah, if you use the state-sponsored plan, which there are three versions of it, there's one where you can just invest in certificates of deposit, another one where you go direct with the plan, and a third, by the way, when I say direct with the plan, you have investment options within it. The third you do through your financial advisor. Yeah. And if you participate in any of three of those options here in the state of Indiana as a resident, you can get up to a $1,000 tax credit by depositing $5,000 in any calendar year.
So ways that I could pay for college for my son include those, or I could dip into my personal savings. It would be a good idea to maybe dip into my 401k.
I'm generally opposed to that. I think, and this is where I'm going to talk like a tough guy, and you know me to be quite the tough guy. So I'll just say this, and I don't ever want to be an expert who makes you feel bad when you hear my advice, but your number one goal in your financial life for most people should be to retire successfully. And that might sound selfish. It might sound like all sorts of things. I just know it's the hardest thing to do. And so, and it's also the most practical thing to do. So to sacrifice that to fund an education for someone else while an act of love is incredibly impractical and borders on irresponsible, believe it or not.
Now, let me move to student loans, either subsidized or unsubsidized. Can you very quickly explain what that means?
All right. So I would just say, actually, there are three methods to pay for a college education. There's pre-fund it, to cash flow it, or there is to pay for it after the fact. And by pay for it after the fact, you're actually talking about student loans. So the difference between a subsidized student loan for undergraduate students really has to do with the fact that it does not accrue interest while you're in school by at least half time, right? You have to be at least a part-time, half-time student, and then the interest does not accrue. Unsubsidized loans, obviously, the interest accrues.
And that is a debt that is taken on by the student, not by me.
That is taken on by the student, yeah. And where this gets hairy is eventually you can cap out, max out the amount of loans, student loans, public student loans, federal student loans that a student can take out. So then the parent is left saying, okay, my student has made it through four semesters. We have at least four semesters to go. We've run out of federal aid. What do we do? And then it gets to, well, I guess I will personally borrow for their education. And that is where very well-meaning people really make giant, giant, giant mistakes. And that's where this NerdWallet survey certainly comes into play as well.
Right. Are you talking about the Parent Plus loans?
Absolutely. Parent Plus loans. And there are Grad Plus loans as well, but I'm specifically talking about Parent Plus loans.
Okay. And then what is a Parent Plus loan?
Parent Plus loan is a student loan that parents take out on behalf of their student. And again, ex-Vice President Pence. Do you call an ex-Vice President ex-Vice President, or do you still say Vice President? How do you do
that? I believe you still say Vice President.
Vice President is like once a Marine, always Marine.
Yeah. Okay.
Vice President Pence actually has Parent Plus loans. It's a common thing. It's a common thing to borrow for your student's education. And I'm not here to talk about his financial situation, but it is also not advisable, generally speaking, to borrow for your student's education personally.
Should I consider taking out a home equity loan to pay for college?
You know, my dad did this, Mason. So when every time I'm asked this question, and I say that in a way that it's like at least six or seven times a day I'm asked this question. No. You know, every time I'm asked this question, I pause because I think about the sacrifice my parents made to get me out of college debt-free. It's not preferable, but I think it's better than taking on Parent Plus loans. Absolutely. And I think it's better than borrowing from a 401k.
Should I take college finance on a year-by-year basis, or should I have a plan for how to pay for the whole enchilada before the very first day of classes?
I have an incredibly unpopular answer, and this is coming from a person who very frequently gives unpopular answers. You need to have a plan for the whole thing, arguably before the start of your student's senior year in high school. Here's why. Yes, you may not have made a school selection at that point in time, but you should have a budget at that point in time. It's not like you're gonna mystically come upon $30,000 that final year of the student's high school education. And the budget's important because it should prevent you from going to a school that you otherwise shouldn't go to from a financial perspective. And I would have to note this, in this NerdWallet study that I keep mentioning, there is a significant portion of parents who suggest that they would not have gone, had their child go to the school they went to, had they known that they'd have that much in Parent Plus loan. In fact, 30% of parents said, if I could do it over, I would ask my child to rethink their education plans so they would not need me to take out a Parent Plus loan. That is to say, the old, hey, Jimmy, we'll figure it out, we'll make it work, is arguably the worst thing you can do, although it seems like good parenting at the time.
We're going to get to that because that feeds into this next question that I have, which is, how much should I be saving for my child's college?
That's actually the trickiest question you've asked in the history of this podcast, Mason. I've listened to every episode, often at night to close my eye. Anyway, here's the issue with that, is that upon deciding you're going to save for college, you have to choose this moving target of, am I going to try to fund a public education, a private education, or am I going to just do the best I can and let that budget force us to make decisions later in the process? That is to say, you know, Mason, let's say you can't fully fund a kid's college education from the time they're born, a public school education. So you're like, oh, I'm just going to put $200 a month in and see what happens come 18 years from now. That's going to give you a budget before their senior year in high school. And that should really dictate school choice, in my opinion.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
What will take you and your people to the stratosphere? News, learning ops, and insights from the benefits, compensation, and people experts at First Person Advisors, now a subsidiary of NFP. Subscribe to The Boost for weekly updates at firstpersonadvisors.com/boost.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast. Our guest this week is Pete the Planner, and we're talking about the do's and don'ts of funding a college education.
I'm going to tell you what I did here. I wasn't aware of this, but when I was doing research for this this podcast, I ran across something called the Vanguard College Saving Planner, which helps you understand how much you will have to save to help pay for college, depending on which college you choose. So it assumes that you're using an investment account, but you can feed in what the return might be on that investment account. You plug in the current age of your child, what the current annual cost of your target school is, and you can feed in whatever target school you want.
Sure.
And then how much you expect to contribute to your account monthly or annually. You can adjust by, you know, the return that you think you're going to get on the account, like I said, and by the degree to which, or by the percentage by, the cost of education goes up every year. It defaults to 5%, that the cost of a college education is going to increase 5% every year. Okay. And so just curious, I mean, do you have a thought about just that figure of 5% per year?
It used to be higher. It has actually come down. It was at one point, I want to say 6.7, if not 7% within the last 10 years. And then organizations or institutions, as I should say, like Purdue started freezing tuition, and that certainly helped. But across the board, it's still in that 5% range. And I think if you're going to do these back of the napkin, back of the Excel spreadsheet figures, then yeah, 5% is a healthy inflation rate for education.
Okay, so I fed it in. So I'm shooting for the moon here. I say, I want my child to go to an Ivy League school. Remember, he's 5 years old. Or something comparable, maybe Stanford or MIT.
Or Hanover College in Southern Indiana.
Okay, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about
Ivy League.
Upper tier. Did you go to Hanover?
Well, yeah, it is the Harvard of the Ohio Valley. So, you know, Ohio River Valley, yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm sticking just with the traditional elite Ivy Tower programs. So here's what I find out. It currently costs about $80,000 per year to attend these schools. If I expect a 5% annual cost increase, it is going to cost me a total of $650,000 between the years 2034 and 2037. That is roughly three times the current value of our house.
You better hope that hand modeling gig comes through. Yeah. You know, it's funny. When I was a financial advisor, story time. When I was a financial advisor, you know, I'd run calculations like that for people, and I'd run them on myself, right? And you see that number, and your first inclination, Mason, is to say, that's ridiculous. Something's gotta change. Inaction is the next step. What I'm suggesting is the world itself is gonna have to change so that I don't have to try to do what I just said I'm going to do. So I feel ya. I have made that same sort of thought. But at some point in time along the way, you just got to say, yeah, hey, Harvard's not an option. You know, frankly, that's the way I view it.
Yeah. And I should say, of course, that I'm not factoring in any kind of grants or scholarships, you know, that might come our way. But yeah, that's the That's the ticker cost.
I will note here, and I'm going to tread lightly because I come on the show to give guidance and not solicit things. But I will note, we've recently here in our offices, we use a particular software that allows parents to compare school choices with GPA, standardized test scores, and the parent's financial situation all taken into mind and into account. And then it says, at this particular school, you are likely to get this aid package based on those factors. And in this school, you're likely to get this one. And these are the two choices you told us about. And so we think option B is better. But in fact, you didn't even mention option C, but based on your student's profile, take a look at C because it will be better for you.
So something like that is available.
It is, yeah.
Okay, so I looked at that and I'm like, oh, that's crazy. Let's look at going to a state school, a Purdue or an IU. Sure. We know that that currently costs $25,000 per year for an in-state student. Again, I expect a 5% annual cost increase. Now I'm looking at about $200,000 between 2034 and 2037. You know, not bad. So this goes back to what we were talking about before. Let's talk about return on investment. So let's say that my son does get into Stanford and Indiana University, both. Okay. In the latter situation, we'll be able to cover most of the total cost. In the Stanford scenario, we're looking at, you know, between myself, my wife, my son, we're looking at taking on a lot of debt, even after grants and scholarships and work study and what have you. A lot of people, I am sure, are going to tell themselves, while they're thinking about how great it's going to be to go to cocktail parties and say that their son goes to Stanford, they're going to say, but it's worth it. Having that degree is worth real money over the course of my son's lifetime. Do you find that to be the case, or do people that you have consulted with, do they really believe in that ROI argument, or are you better off going to the state school?
As I tend to do from time to time, I would just like to note that I am not the end-all be-all authority on this. So my opinion, while an educated opinion, is not the end-all be-all. But no, it's not worth it, and here's why. Because if it capped out at your son having a ton of loans to then leverage the education to pay off, then arguably. But Mason, your financial life is not enhanced by your students' better education. And the argument's always like, well, they'll be around to help me out. No, look, I'm sure you're a great dad, but that's not gonna happen. I mean, you very, very rarely see a student go to a better school because it's the better school, and then it's like, don't worry, everybody. I'm gonna make so much money that I will take care of everything. It just doesn't happen that way. So your student making the calculated decision to leverage their own education for an income decision is apples and oranges from a parent saying, I'm going to martyr my finances to the student's detriment eventually, because you're going to have to move in with them in order to make the student better financially. It makes no sense. And that's where I had to have the disclaimer, because I sound like a callous human.
So somewhere in this planning process, I need to prioritize my own retirement, my wife's retirement. What I'm hearing you say is over my desire to pay for my son's education.
I am ashamed of the analogy that I'm about to use. It's the old put your oxygen mask on first before assisting others on the plane. And you have to remove your face covering first before you put the mask on. That's neither here nor there. But that's the truth. Number one priority, every person, retirement. You can't ruin your retirement. You shouldn't ruin your retirement by trying to fund college. You just shouldn't. It's impractical.
Okay.
I think it's fair that I know how I'm paying for college. This is my strategy. We are saving aggressively because I just don't think my kids are good enough at soccer to get a scholarship. So we're saving aggressively. But here's what we're going to do. We think we'll have close to enough money for the kids to go places. However, we've also structured so our mortgage will be paid off before my daughter starts college. So that's to suggest we have a very large house payment right now that we're purposefully making large so that there will be a large margin within our budget to cash flow whatever else we need to do. And to me, well, of course to me, that's a brilliant strategy because I refuse to go into debt. I am willing to use our household income to help with it, both now and later. And beyond that, I don't want my kids to graduate with debt, so I'm going to help and make sure they make a school choice that reflects that.
Yeah, we did the 15-year, so we're going to be way in the clear. 15-year mortgage, folks.
And by the way, of course I love that, but in your mind, that has to be part of your strategy. Like you have to assign whatever your principal and interest payment is right now and say that is going to help with the monthly bills you receive from the university.
Now, what do we need to make sure our kids know about money before they go to college? You know, back in the 80s when I went to college, you know, my mom sat down and gave me kind of the birds and the bees talk finally.
Oh my God.
At the age of 18, but we didn't really say anything about money.
Well, I talk about money with my kids all the time. So again, this is my opinion. I think having a young adult, I guess we'll call them teens, get a job is the absolute best thing you can do to teach your kids about money. Because if for the first 22 years of a person's life, they don't have to earn the money that is spent on their behalf, that's just, it's cognitive dissonance. It's tough for anyone to get their head around that. So I think working as soon as the state will let you is a great way to teach kids about money. And I'm proud to say my daughter, who is 12, she can't wait to work. Like, she wants a work permit now. And it's one of the things I'm most proud of her.
I didn't know about this. So you need to get a permit from the state for somebody under a particular age.
Yeah, it's something like 14. There's special rules in Indiana. There's actually legislation that just changed on it. But you have to go to your school, and your school issues a work permit on behalf of the state or something like that.
And what is the earliest or youngest you can be?
I think it's 14, but you can actually be like a soccer referee. Oddly enough, it's like an exception as a sports referee, and you can only ref for children who are younger than you.
Now, when our kids arrive on campus, they will be beset by people wanting to give them credit cards.
You know, I will say that idea was certainly much more prevalent in your day and in my day. It seems to be less prevalent today.
Oh, okay. What do you think, though, about helping your child get a credit card to have for college for incidental expenses or travel or surprises?
Every step of the way of my parenting journey, I find myself given real hot takes and advice on what parents should do when I've not yet reached that level. So let's do that again. I don't feel like you should get your kid a credit card when they go to college. I don't think that makes any sense. I think there can be other means of practical ways to deal with issues. And I also think the guise of, well, I got to help them build credit is a little bit silly when there are so many other ways to build credit. So I think one of the ways you can teach your kids about money is to not get them a credit card when they go to college. It doesn't make sense.
I got the credit card second day on campus. With a $500 credit limit, which I maxed out almost immediately and then spent several years paying off.
Do you remember what you bought so quickly?
Oh, my Lord. I very likely whiskey sours.
Yeah, those go down well. Especially several of them.
$6 at a shot. I don't know. I mean, boy, that's a good question. I don't remember. I know that I had to send Visa kind of regular updates on how I was doing on finally paying it off.
I didn't have credit card in college. I worked a lot during the summer. I would always make $3,000 to $4,000 a summer in the late 90s. And my freshman year, I spent roughly $1,800 on Papa John's and then new pants. All the Papa John's. So it tracks.
Well, what have I not asked? What important element of college finance have we not covered?
You know, I think this really boils down to, if you're not going to fully fund college, and that's not to be a haves or have not situation. That's to say, like, just the math of it. If you're unable to fully fund college, you have a choice between two elements there. Number one, have an uncomfortable conversation with your teen before they make their school choice. If you don't want to do that, which most people don't, if I'm being honest, because it requires you to be very transparent about your own ability to earn and save. And some people, just because they don't talk to their kids about money when they're, you know, your son's age, Mason, it just doesn't track. So they don't have that conversation. So that's choice A, uncomfortable conversation with your teen. Choice B is uncomfortable family moment upon graduation when it's time to pay the piper. And there is no in between. It's either, hey, we're going to do the math right now, and it is just math. We're not guessing. This is math. That's why you got to have the whole funding mechanism worked out before they go to school. Or you say, you know what, let's see what happens. We'll just figure it out later. And that figuring out later is the worst when it comes to college. It just absolutely is. We see it around here. Parents, story time. I was down in Kentucky several years ago helping a utility worker with his finances. And he was wanting to retire in the next 2 years. He had a pension. And I was asked something to the effect of, well, is there any unusual expenses come and due? Well, something like that. And he's like, well, I do have some school debt for my kids that I took on. And I was like, well, how much? He's like, I don't really know. So he called me back, $130,000. And he said, is that a lot? And I said, well, it's enough to prevent you from retiring in the next couple of years, you know? And that's common. It's incredibly common because the narrative, and I hate when people say that, the narrative in the media is you must go to college to improve your chance at a better job and more income. But the other side of the narrative, the context, is the parents have to throw themselves down a pit to make that happen, and it just can't be that way.
I think for folks that really aren't money savvy, I think putting together that plan at the beginning of their child's senior year of college sounds pretty foreboding. What is your advice for getting it done?
I think what you're going to see in the coming years is that school systems are going to get really smart around that idea. Now, don't get me wrong. School systems want their high school graduates to go to colleges, and they want them to go to very nice colleges. They really do. But I think the right guidance departments are going to have the mechanism to help parents do that math. It's not as simple as going to your local financial advisor and helping them do the math on that, because it is somewhat a specialized calculation. But with a little Googling, maybe even a little Binging, I think you can find a cost calculator and online that helps you understand what your student loan burden should be. I will also note one of the worst places you can do this, and this sounds like I'm going to regret this, is to go to an admissions office at a university during your selection process and have them run it for you. I'm not here to suggest necessarily that they treat the price of an education like a piece of jewelry at a jewelry store where that's not really the price. But that tends to happen from time to time. And very quickly, you get confused and you end up selecting that school based on this anecdotal cost, and it is not that.
All right, well, let's call it right there and check in 13 years.
I can't have any less hair by then, so let's have at it.
All right. Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
My thanks again to Pete Dunn. Now, just a reminder, his column on personal finance appears regularly in the print edition of IBJ, and you can find several years' worth of his work at IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest print edition of IBJ I'd like to point out. First up, Eli Lilly and Company's antibody treatment for COVID-19 is back on the market, ending a 2-month suspension by the FDA. John Russell reports that the drug cocktail is back in regulators' good graces after proving effective against the Delta variant. Also in this week's issue, Kurt Christian reports that Remax is suing one of its local franchisees for allegedly instructing his employees to join a national competitor so that he could later follow them and collect a recruitment bonus. And Mickey Shuey explains how city officials are trying to address the futures of the huge municipal buildings downtown that largely will be vacated as agencies move to the new Community Justice Campus. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it is quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.